Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Call. Rose is out today. Last December, animal lovers countrywide mourned the death of P22. That was his name. He was a mountain lion who lived in Griffith Park in the Santa Monica Mountains, and he wandered the Hollywood Hills, an urban, wild animal living in both human and animal territory. He was a celebrity, showed up in TV, books, even art, but that doesn't erase the fact that P22 is a symbol of a very modern problem, the Wildland Urban Interface, WUI. Humans are expanding their footprint into what's been up to now reliably untouched by humans. That can turn out badly for both. Wildfires, that is, sweep through forested communities with much more fuel than they find in the city. Bears become acclimated to humans, breaking into cars to get at all kinds of goodies while the oblivious owner is off on a hike. Well-intended people will pick up and bring inside an abandoned baby deer. They don't realize mom's just off getting food, and she does plan to come back. Then there's climate change, and that wraps all over the rest of the problems. Polar bears move into human settlements searching for food. The drought in Tanzania forces elephants to do the same thing. Crops get damaged, the elephants get killed. Whales in warming waters are changing their migration patterns, increasing collisions with ships. On today's show, we're discussing the rise in human-wildlife conflict with the additional impact of the climate crisis. What should be done to protect animals living in wild spaces that are no longer as wild? What can humans do to prepare for more interactions with creatures that we're not used to contending with? We have two guests today. We'll first hear from Anne Bryant. She's executive director of Bear League, a volunteer community-based organization in the Lake Tahoe Basin, committed to keeping bears safe and wild in their natural habitat. Anne lives in Homewood, California, a tiny town south of Tahoe City. Dr. Christine Wilkinson is a carnivore ecologist and conservation scientist based at UC Berkeley and the California Academy of Sciences. She studies social ecological drivers of carnivore movement, ecology, and coexistence. We'll get more on that in just a moment. But first, let's talk to Anne. Welcome, Anne. It's good to talk to you.
Hello. How are you, Angie?
I'm well. Thank you. We got to talk about the Bear League. The New York Times called the league kind of a 911 service for people's bear-related emergencies. And it is getting harder to keep bears from safe from humans, isn't it?
You know, there's more and more humans, and they think there's too many bears. The bears think that it's just the opposite. Yes, it is. It's an ongoing problem, and it's escalating. Especially here at Tahoe, where we're in charge of kind of answering these phones. So it's pretty much 24/7 all year long.
I want to stay with that New York Times story because it paints such a picture of what you're dealing with. First of all, I have to credit you for the line, 50% of the time we coach idiots. That put a delicious spin on this. But you talked about a guy who left a trail of cookies in his yard because he wanted to get a picture of a bear eating cookies while he was on his couch eating, watching TV. There was a father at a campground who put peanut butter on his kid's face because he wanted a bear to come up and lick it off. He wanted a photograph of the bear kissing his child. And another father of an 8-year-old put food in his daughter's hand, then filmed her feeding a bear like it was a dog's. Bears, you say, are not dogs. These people must be just the tip of an iceberg, the exceptional ones who do something really stupid. And then we have, and I'd like you to expound on this, the ones who are just doing what campers do and encounter bears because that space is more and more occupied between the two of them.
That's true. We've got the whole gamut of different types of people, the ones that are just trying to enjoy, and then a bear walks through and they can handle it. They know that this is bear territory. Then we have these people that come from the city with their city mentality into the forest, and they want to see bear, so they'll bait them and do like the peanut butter on the cheek trick. It's mind-boggling sometimes, and we have to try and be nice and diplomatic when we're trying to talk to these people to let them know you really can't do that. You're creating a problem not only for yourself but a long-time problem for the bears. So it's just it's never ending though, and it's shocking sometimes.
Yeah. How extensive are efforts to educate people before they go, say, to Yosemite or show up at Tahoe? If they make a reservation in a place that's clearly bear territory or other wild animal territory, Does your hotel confirmation come with some information about how to stay away from bears? I mean, are city people just coming in with no clue as to what they're into?
Unfortunately, a lot of them do come in with absolutely no idea that they're coming into bear country. They have been given no information. We try and get word out via the media, and especially, you know, TV news, radio news, newspapers, as much as we can. But a lot of people arrive and they had no idea, and they're just shocked and they don't know how to handle it. They don't know what to do. Also, a lot of the short-term rentals don't want people to know that there's bears here because that they're afraid that that will scare them away from coming and spending money here. So some are not like that. They want people to know, and they should realize that if a guest comes to stay and they didn't know there were bears here and they do everything wrong and attract the bears and have a bad experience with them, they're never going to come back. Whereas if they knew ahead of time what to do to avoid having a problem, they would probably come for their vacation many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ABC News reported that from July to early August this year, up to 50 bears were hit by cars. 20 of them were killed, 20 in 5 weeks in and around Tahoe. And there were another 7 injured. Now, this is an interesting example of approaching a problem and finding at least some solution. And these are lighted signs, the same kind of signs you'd see that say Highway 280 is closed, except they say, you know, warning, this is bear territory. And it seems like those signs are having some good effect.
Yes, those signs have helped. They're only so far in the city of South Lake Tahoe, just one little town that did do installation of those. This was right before the Labor Day weekend, which we were in such great fear would have just massive encounters with cars and bears. They helped. It was amazing. They were something new, and I think people paid attention to them. You saw something different on the side of the road, and it was blinking lights. It said, warning, wildlife crossing, you know, slow down. We experienced far less collisions during the time that those signs were out. So we're trying really hard to get them in the rest of the Tahoe Basin area, probably have them moved around a little bit so that they don't become something that people get used to and ignore. Mm-hmm. But they did help.
Are you seeing climate change related effects on the availability of food and water for the bears?
Well, the drought definitely has had problems for them in the past. Now that heavy snowfall last winter helped with a really bumper crop of pine nuts right now. Mm-hmm. And the fruit, the berries, the currant bushes, manzanita berries. We had plenty of food this year. It is changing the way the bears move and their hibernation / torpor experience. They're sleeping less because it's, you know, our winters are not as cold.
Mm-hmm. Is there any plan, any sort of looking ahead to say, here's how we can deal better with bears who aren't sleeping so long? Here's how we can do better with bears who don't have access to water? What kind of anticipation is happening with solutions?
Well, there's always talk about what, you know, things like this, that what can we do? But a lot of it would be unnatural and we live here at Tahoe. There's lake. There's the lake right there, and there's streams running pretty much year-round all over. You just can't go more than a few blocks without a stream trickling through. So the water is not a problem for animals to drink. If there isn't enough, the vegetation dries up, and then the food source can be compromised. But we have in the past planted berry bushes in the backcountry, but they're not. You have to go and water them for several years, and then the deer come and just eat them. So that's been, it was a well thought out plan, but it didn't really materialize into anything that provided food for them. But like I said, I think they have enough food. They also, of course, come into where there's people that are negligent with their trash, and they have their bird feeders hanging all over in their yards. We call them bear feeders. So they get plenty to eat. That's not a problem.
That's interesting. So tell me, I mean, one last question here, and I just want to give you the megaphone that it probably helps you to have. If you were to be able to educate people on what they need to know going into bear country, I'm sure that could go on for paragraphs and paragraphs, but what is it that most people don't know? What is the most common mistake they're making that you would like to warn them against?
Well, there's a lot on that list, but I'll grab that microphone and say, understand these animals before you come into where they ancestrally live. They've been here for thousands and thousands of years. They belong here. Just because there's people here now is not a reason for the bears to be mistreated or to be so-called relocated to back in the hill country somewhere. There is no place to relocate bears anymore. That is not an answer. People need to be responsible while living or recreating in bear country. We can all do this together. We're here to help with that. These bears are not man-eating monsters. There has never been a case of a black bear, which is all we have in California now. Mm. No black bear has ever killed a human being in all of written history anywhere in California, Nevada, or Oregon.
Wow.
So they're not dangerous.
Did not know that. And Bryant, thank you so much. This has been really interesting.
Thank you.
Ann Bryant, Executive Director of Bear League. You can find that group's site at savebears.org. And we move on to our other guest today, Dr. Christine Wilkinson. Christine is a carnivore ecologist and conservation scientist based at UC Berkeley and the California Academy of Sciences. Christine, welcome.
Hi there. How's it going?
Life's good. I need you to tell us what a carnivore ecologist is.
Great question. So a carnivore ecologist is essentially someone that studies carnivores, their biology, how their biology interacts with their surroundings, how they move through space and time and survive.
You know, I was looking up some of your papers and found so much that's directly on point for today, including one that really helps to frame everything we're about to say in the rest of the discussion. Human-wildlife interactions, one of your papers says, HWIs, are pervasive, and future global change will exacerbate negative outcomes. Traditionally, HWIs have been framed as occurring along a conflict coexistence continuum where win-win scenarios are sought. HWIs should rather be considered as a life cycle to incorporate the plethora of outcomes where interactions could be positive, negative, or neutral for one partner in the dyad that vary in importance and over time. That's kind of a shift from what we usually see as, you know, if I'm building a housing development, how do we keep the deer out? If I'm a rancher, how do we keep the pumas out? It's less one wins over the other.
That's right. Yeah. So we think a lot about human-wildlife conflict, but we don't think about how those interactions can be neutral and positive because we've largely been, at least in this country, very reactive to living with wildlife instead of preparing for it ahead of time.
So what would a win-win scenario look like? For example, in my particular neighborhood, coyotes are feared and hated. There's less and less coyote areas in the hills, you know, because more and more houses are being built. People see them and panic. They're going to eat my dog. They're going to, you know, they're going to bite me. They're going to chase me. It seems like it'd be hard to find a win-win here because as long as you have people there, they don't want the coyotes there. What would a win-win look like?
Yeah, so coyote interactions in San Francisco are very special. We actually have a paper coming out soon that describes sort of all of the trends of those interactions across a data set that goes back more than 10 years that's been curated by San Francisco Animal Care and Control. Mm-hmm. And something that's very special about San Francisco, as you noted, is that there are, you know, these very small green spaces and the coyotes are denning in these green spaces and then kind of moving out of them every now and then to access human resources. So the things that I like to tell people, both East Bay, San Francisco, and elsewhere, to prevent conflicts with coyotes are multi-pronged. First, people need to be securing their attractants, similar to what Anne was talking about with the bears, making sure that trash is not available, that compost is not available, that you put those bins out only on the day when they're going to be collected. And supporting policies that help us to do that also in parks, making sure that our trash bins aren't overflowing, that we have trash bins that are well secured and aren't sort of open to animals, coyotes and otherwise. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we've seen with the coyotes, at least in San Francisco, is that a lot of the perceived and realized conflicts involve people who have their dogs. And a lot of the time, people really, really value the freedom that they have with their dogs, and they don't want to follow leash laws where there are leash recommendations in certain areas of the city. So that leads into, you know, coyotes and dogs starting to play with each other or one chasing the other. And it's very scary. It can be very frightening to have those interactions with coyotes. Mm-hmm. But people need to be paying attention. You know, in the Parks and Rec put up these signs that tell you when the coyotes are denning and where and what trails to avoid in general, especially with your dog, and where to have dogs on versus off leash. And kind of just paying attention to those and recognizing our part in coexistence is really, really important.
So I want to look at that in terms of the frame you put on it. That's as close to a win-win scenario as we can get. Living in that same area, being less fearful of the coyotes having less to fear from the humans. But you recommend that we look at these interfaces and interactions as a life cycle, incorporating a number of outcomes, looking for positive interactions. Is that what you're describing when we first started to talk about the win-win and you started to expand about it? Is there a life cycle considered in there?
Yeah, so I think especially for San Francisco, I'm using it as a case study because it's just so fascinating, because a lot of other places in the country, you can actually just kill coyotes if they annoy you. No problem. Whereas in San Francisco County, you can't. That's not a thing that's not part of their policy. And folks in general lean toward, you know, even if they fear or hate coyotes, there are always a chunk of people that love the coyotes as well. And what that translates into is that folks aren't really well educated about helping coyotes to maintain their natural wariness of us. Mm-hmm. And so they might be like, oh, okay, I yelled at it once and it sort of stopped or started walking more slowly toward me and now I can walk away. When really, like, the answer about how to properly haze an animal is to haze them, you know, yell, so on, until they're all the way out of the scene. And that's not something that San Franciscans tend to do either, because they like coyotes. They think that that's maybe they don't want to scare them, or because they just don't know. And so, like, a win-win in the case of coyote interactions in an urban area would be no interaction, right? It would be making sure that those animals are maintaining their natural wariness of us.
Mm-hmm. I want to go forward with those points that came from this paper that you worked on. Integrating responsibility, equity, justice, and inclusion as governing principles in the development and practice of conservation activities can reduce conflicts between humans and wildlife. I don't think people often look at, you know, how do I keep a bear out of my car? And they say responsibility, equity, justice, and inclusion. So I was fascinated that those showed up, that terminology showed up. Tell me how to integrate those two thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. So something about me as far as how I got to this field was that I was originally just interested in wildlife. And you've noted that now I'm very interested in the societal elements as well and in how people are experiencing these interactions. And the reason for that stems from this element around equity and responsibility. I first got into this when I was many, many years ago studying in East Africa, really interested in just the wildlife. And I had one of my Kenyan friends say to me, if a person kills a lion here, the government will be here within a day or two to arrest that person. But if a lion kills a person, the government may never come here to give any compensation or acknowledgement. And that really shifted me into understanding how these top-down policies and societal factors and community experiences are just as important, if not more important, than what the wildlife are actually doing in these interactions. And a lot of the time, you'll see that there are top-down policies dictating, either from the government or from someone else, dictating how communities are allowed to interact with animals. And that creates issues where people who, say, rely on livestock for their livelihoods and the livestock are being killed by lions, but the lions are protected, mm-hmm. can create these issues of inequity that just is a perpetual negative cycle where people's livelihoods are impacted. They then resent these animals more. Maybe there's more poisoning. There's more anti-coyote, anti-lion, whatever sentiment. Because of these actual experiences and because of their experiences with other people that are in charge.
Now, in the time that you've been working on this, from the time you first had an interest in it to where you are today, what changes have you seen in the urban wildlife interface that are obviously due to climate change?
Yeah, well, I mean, our California specific changes that we have are the wildfires are that are climate induced and, of course, stem from a bunch of mismanagement and not including indigenous practices for many, many years have been massive and have ended up pushing wildlife out, you know, increasing things like wildlife vehicle collisions with animals needing to move out of those spaces. In some cases, animals going into human dominated landscapes to access food and water when these wildfires happen. And then the other thing, of course, is more and more urbanization. I think the Bay Area doesn't have that issue a lot because we have these sort of extremely restrictive zoning laws. But you see that in a lot of other places that I work where people are kind of expanding further and further into wildlife habitat and coming into closer contact with animals.
You know, we already have callers checking in, so I might as well officially open the phones. Our phone number is 866-798-8255 if you'd like to contribute to our conversation. 866-798-8255. Dr. Christine Wilkinson is my guest, and we're talking about the urban wildlife interface, particularly with an eye toward climate change, how that's going to make it worse, and how we can try to deal with that as it's coming up. Now, we do have a caller who did not stay on the line but did want to ask us a question. Let me bring that up in front of my face. Chandra in San Francisco wanted to discuss Utah being an open range state, and that gives ranchers the right to let their livestock roam freely along rural roadways. And Chandra says her boyfriend got into a car accident hitting animals on the freeway. So can you talk about how we can better prepare people for livestock vehicle encounters?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just a side note about the interesting history of many of our rangelands in the U.S. Is that a lot of them used to be very much open range, right? And the reason for that is because we killed off all of our predators. So speaking of conflict, like one of the biggest things now is that we have predators recovering in the rangelands, and we as people in the U.S. are having to learn how to coexist with them for the first time. And so what we've seen with both predators, and also this would apply for the issues that the caller is talking about with livestock on the road, is that there are efforts to make things like wildlife crossings, make fences along the roadside that essentially funnel wildlife onto these crossings to be able to cross more safely and avoid collisions. There's also, I think Anne also mentioned something about signage around wildlife crossings has been really, really helpful. So doing those studies that allow us to see maybe where livestock are roaming, just like we look at where wildlife are roaming across roads at different times of the year for different resources, can help us to know where to put that signage and where to put those crossings more efficiently.
And the wildlife crossings are really interesting. There's, and of course, I can't pull it out of thin air, but there's a wonderful video on YouTube where a wildlife crossing was established over a freeway. So this is an area with grass and leaves and trees. It looks completely like a wildlife area, except there's a freeway running underneath it. And there's a time-lapse camera that showed how many and how many different kinds of animals were wandering across that wildlife crossing in any given night. And I think what most of us can learn from this is, one, animals will use them. Even if you build it, they will come. And the other thing is just how many animals are involved here. We may think about, well, we'll save the deer, and instead, yeah, you see the deer, but you see the possums and you see snakes. And you see all kinds of that. Wildlife crossings, I think, might be one of the most productive ways to look at this.
That's right. And I'm really glad that you mentioned P22 at the beginning of this show, because P22, I wrote a little piece about him because he was so inspiring for people because people felt really connected to him. He was, I think, an example of one of the positive outcomes of anthropomorphizing animals, because there can be negative ones as well. And the reason for that is when people were really connected to him, and then he started to, you know, he became ill and injured, and he started to attack people's dogs and so on. Typically what you would see, as I'm sure you've seen with coyotes, is that people would be like all up in arms trying to get that animal caught and killed. This time everyone was like, oh, poor P22. What's wrong with him? You know, the attitude was different because that storyline had been established. And then when he passed away, it was like this enormous catalyst for the Wallace Annenberg Wildlife Crossing, which has broken ground in Southern California, to be able to provide a crossing over that massive freeway there, all because of this storyline and this connection that people had with an individual animal. So I think a lot when we're talking about climate change, you know, exacerbating habitat fragmentation, exacerbating the way that we have to share these spaces and these resources with animals. I think about ways that we can create stories to encourage these massive policies to go underway, like what happened in that case.
We've got some other callers in, and we're going to get to the phones right after we take a break here. And we're going to pick up this conversation about P22 because there's an interesting idea in there as well. We'll get to that. Dr. Christine Wilkinson is on the line. She's with UC Berkeley and the California Academy of Sciences. I'm Angie Caro, sitting in for Rose today, and this is Your Call. Let's do take some of those phone calls here on Your Call. I'm Angie Caro with Dr. Christine Wilkinson, and Dell is waiting for us in Oakland. Hi, Dell.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing good.
That's this conversation. I live next to a creek, and if you guys know about creeks, it's like a highway for animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had to catch skunks and raccoons and possums and all that good stuff. But what comes down to is it was all my fault.
How do you mean?
I left dog food out. I left things out that attracted them, so they started coming into my yard. So I feel like we need to take responsibility in understanding what they're attracted to. Close your garbages, just like with bears. We have a certain kind of, we have rules for them. We should have the same for our backyards.
That speaks to the problem we see in so many areas, Dell. I'm glad you brought that up. Christine, your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks so much for bringing that up. And you're absolutely right. So we do, as I mentioned, you know, it's a social ecological issue. And part of it is our responsibility. And especially in urban areas, you have these animals that are usually at least tolerant of us or even synanthropic, where they kind of benefit from us and our resources. And so they're quite good at navigating through where we live and taking advantage of what we leave out. So yeah, definitely keeping that food indoors. I know a lot of people in the East Bay also like to feed feral cats. I really discourage that. Like, leaving food out like that can then attract other animals. It can also get your cats killed if you attract coyotes. You know, if you're interested in cats, that's a whole other story. And then making sure that you secure your trash cans. And if you're worried about, you know, an animal like a coyote, which of course can jump for more than 6 feet tall, you can, if you have a yard, you can make sure that that yard has something called coyote rollers on top of your fence.
Really?
Which basically prevents them from getting perched on the top of the fence by rolling, you know, very well named.
Oh.
And keeping your dogs in sight, making sure that they're not necessarily out there alone, especially if they're small. We haven't had issues with dogs or anything being attacked in the East Bay. But if you have animals that are more stressed, so like I did hear of a mangy coyote near Richmond a few weeks ago, they can be more likely to come in and try to get these human resources. So that's the kind of thing to look out for, especially, I think, related to climate change. If these animals are more stressed because of fewer resources, less resource availability, they might kind of come into these areas more often, and securing our attractants is going to be even more important.
You know, along that line, and you did bring up cats, there's a certain responsibility that humans have to be realistic about where they live and what shares the space with them. And I'm thinking particularly on a neighborhood message board where you're always seeing two messages next to each other where one says, wow, there was a mountain lion on my porch the other, because we get mountain lions where we are. There was a mountain lion on my porch the other day. And just after that, you say, hey, my tabby cat didn't come back last night. Well, if you live in an area, this is where, as Dell said, it's human responsibility to say, I live in mountain lion country. I live in coyote country. Maybe I need to watch out for my cat.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's really what that kind of thing is what's gotten me so interested in people's perceptions and like in the human experience, right? Because when I see those posts on Nextdoor, two things happen for me. The first thing that happens is like, I had a cat and I love cats. I love cats and dogs, cat and dog person. And if my cat were to have disappeared or died, like that is very sad. And you have to start from a place of empathy with folks, even if they're maybe not taking the responsibility to, help their cat to survive. Like that's an emotional thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people grew up in places where maybe outdoor cats were in less danger, or they used them maybe as barn cats, or they just, you know, think that it's the right thing to do and they're coming from a good place. But the reality is, so the second thing that happens when I see these posts is trying to tell people like some of the science, like if you're living near predators, your cats are going to be in danger. If you're living near a lot of roads, your cats are in danger from being hit by a car. Cats have been shown to be the number one killer of wild birds in a lot of different places, including the U.S. So you're kind of putting our wildlife in threat as well if you care about wildlife. And a lot of the times these people do care about wildlife. And then you can give them something more optimistic, right? So starting from this place of empathy, being like, I know it's really hard to maybe keep your cat indoors. I know it's really emotional if you lose your cat to predation. Try taking your cat outdoors on a leash and a harness. If you have the space and the time, build a catio. Have a you know, sort of a cat patio out off of your window that they can enter and exit at their free will, to give them that experience if that's what the place that you're coming from. So there are answers to all of these issues. It's just how we can work together with folks to get there.
I want to reassure those of you who are waiting on the phone. We're going to get back to you in just a moment. I do want to touch, though, and this is something that you glanced up against a couple of times, Christine, and that is people's empathy with P22 and trying to encourage people to have more empathy with wildlife and live more peacefully with them. You contributed to a paper that looked at the pros and cons of giving animals names instead of numbers or codes. That wouldn't have been P22. That would have been Carl the lion. And the paper said human connections to individual animals can change the course of conservation. I'm going to ask you about that, and can you also address whether we can get people to care more about climate change if they're talking about how it affects a bison named Willie than bison C25? So can you talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. So first caveat before I go into some of those examples is that my follow-up to that paper I'm hoping to do collaboratively with some folks is making a decision tree about when naming or kind of creating these narratives around individual animals would be helpful for conservation and when it could be harmful. And I can talk about when it would be harmful as well. But when it'd be helpful, some of the examples that I use in there, aside from P22, are there are quite a lot of different initiatives where people can donate money to conservation, to like landscape scale conservation initiatives in order to name, say, the new baby giraffe at the zoo, or right, name the lion that's going to be collared. And then be able to, there are other initiatives. Some of them are the same ones. Some of them are different, where you can buy something that then the money that you use goes into the conservation of the species. And then you can track them. You can be part of the tracking from the GPS collars that are on the animals, not in a way that puts the animals in danger by people knowing too much about them, but maybe getting like a weekly or monthly update of where they've been. And that is a way that you can kind of connect with their stories. So if, say, I don't know if you said Billy the Bison, if the bison's ranges are shifting over time and you're following Billy the Bison and his herd, and you're noticing this, and the scientists that are studying Billy the Bison are putting out these stories about the issues that the bison are facing through, resource shortage and so on and so forth, then you are connecting with that. And if you live near that area, maybe you can be involved in advocacy and policies around the climate change issues that these animals are facing. So that's just an example of how, and there are many more, of how people can connect both with animals now and also with animals that are going to be facing climate change issues.
This is fascinating. Back to the phones, and we're going to talk to Robert in San Francisco. Hey, Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi. My wife and I recently drove up to Banff and Jasper National Parks in Canada. And in Banff, the major road that goes through the national park is all fenced, and they have wildlife overpasses. In fact, they're still constructing a few. And then we took a tour, a wilderness tour in Jasper, and the tour guide told us that Jasper was considering to do the same thing, but they decided to look at the statistics of animals lost through predators or killed on the highway. And they found out these overpasses actually are just focusing the prey through these overpasses, and the wolves and the other predators have figured it out, and they're taking down as many predators, deer, elk, whatever, on these overpasses, and they would have lost on the highway through roadkill.
Wow, that's fascinating. Christine, your thoughts on that?
That's really interesting, Robert, and I think I've heard of some other situations like that as well, where essentially, you know, these overpasses or fences, et cetera, can funnel prey in a way that's advantageous to predators.
Exactly.
And It's interesting because it really underlying that are a couple of things. So one thing is when we think about wildlife vehicle collisions, often those of us who love wildlife and the outdoors jump to, oh no, the wildlife, but it's actually a public health challenge as well. Right. So, you know, I don't know if the calculations took into account the fact that X amount of people will still hit a deer on every year, possibly injuring or hurting or getting killed, you know, themselves. And what does that mean? Right. So that gets into that societal, that social element. And the other thing is there's also a lot out there where it's not just about human wildlife conflict with just like predators versus people or deer on the roads versus people. It's also, say, certain groups of hunters are like, we don't want our prey populations to be depleted by predator recovery. And so there's people who are anti-wolf, anti-so on, because they're afraid that the prey populations will be depleted. And so the real question is, like, to what extent, and of course, I don't know about this situation, and I'd love to hear more about it. To what extent did they study sort of the prey population dynamics and how stable they are despite this overpass funneling? And then how does that match up with the public health challenge that people will still face on the roads if they don't put overpasses? So these are all the different calculations that we're putting into effect. And, you know, these types of calculations come into play also when you're like protecting or recovering predators that are conflict prone. So there's that element. But then they're also maybe hunting animals like prey, wild prey that are endangered, right? Like mm-hmm. bighorn sheep. And that's a whole other set of conflicts. So there are a lot of different calculations that are both scientific and value laden when you're thinking about these conservation measures.
Yeah, this is interesting because when I was talking to Ann earlier of the Bear League, we were talking about the number of bears that were hit in just the space of 5 weeks, 50 bears hit, 20 of them killed. And the part we didn't touch on, of course, is that here's a human being driving at speed, smacking into a 500-pound animal. So one thing we didn't touch on is what happens with people. And at the very least, if we're looking at the wildlife crossings, at least you're taking the people out of the equation, so they're not getting hit.
That's right. Yeah. So at the very least, and a lot of this, again, as I said, is based around these value judgments. And so I think in an ideal world, we would be able to get all the stats that I just talked about. Mm-hmm. But often there are values involved and politics involved, and a really rapid response is needed if there are immediate issues. So you can't always get all of the stats that we need. And that's why I think one of the main policies, especially with climate change, exacerbating some of these issues, is more funding for more studies on these elements so that we have those stats ready to go for policies to be enacted more dynamically.
If you're just tuning in, this is Your Call. I'm Angie Coiro in for Rose today, and I'm talking to Dr. Christine Wilkinson. We're talking about the urban-wildlife interface where we all have to share space with animals moving further into human territory and vice versa, and the elements of climate change that are affecting that as well. We've got people on the phone lines waiting, but we do have one line open at 866-798-8255, and we'd love to have you contribute to the show. 866-798-8255. Peter is checking in from Florida. Peter, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Hi, Peter. We might have the wrong line. I don't know if we have Peter there.
Hello?
Hello, there you are. Hi.
Okay. I'm telling you the truth. I'm eating Cheerios right now.
If you'd like to make a call...
Sorry, we're having a little phone problem there. That's okay. Do we still have you, Peter? Oh,
you'd like to make a call.
That's too bad. I'm sorry that happened. Peter, hang on. We're going to figure out what this little phone foo is, and we're going to get you back on and enjoy your Cheerios in the meantime. So, Christine, I do want to go back to what we were talking about earlier, and that is trying to work out a life cycle way of interacting with these animals. And you and I have been talking now about people running into, you know, not squirrels, not raccoons, but we're talking about bears. It strikes me that there is something less cyclical about our problems with bears. It seems that the two elements have been stable for so long. There are humans who are camping around bears. There are bears that are seeing humans as a food source. And can you talk about the cyclical approach that you looked at later, looking at as a life cycle sort of thing? Does that have applicability in what appears to be a stable situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think Anne is the expert here, but some stuff that I think will be applicable with the life cycle is when we're thinking about climate change effects. Like there have been cases, I think in Colorado there was a study and some others, where because of the warming temperatures due to climate change, you know, different resources are becoming short for bears, right? So things like the berries and so on that they eat are not happening at the same times of year. There are not as many of them. And also their hibernations can become shorter as well. Mm-hmm. And so as we start to prepare people, maybe people who are accustomed to coexisting with bears and those who are not, so, you know, Tahoe being a very major visitor center, it's important to keep in account kind of the forecasting of climate year to year and make sure that people can be prepared in a dynamic way to interact with animals that might come out of hibernation earlier or might be facing, you know, fewer resources than they're used to because the resources maybe bloomed earlier in the year. So I think that there are elements to take this life cycle and apply it to the dynamic nature of climate change, both for bears and otherwise. I think that applying the life cycle to a dynamic system on terrestrial spaces hasn't happened as much as in some marine spaces, especially off the coast of California. So Brianna Abrams and her team wrote this couple of amazing papers about climate change impacts on human wildlife interactions, both in the marine space and the terrestrial space. And there were only, I think, 49 studies that they looked at. But then they provided some, you know, optimistic ways forward toward the end, or examples of successes toward the end. And one of them was thinking about how these marine heat waves and then algal blooms have put, you know, whales into contact with ships more often than they would be in the past, because their migration seasons are now lining up differently with where ships would be at certain times of year. And then also with crab fisheries as well. So getting entangled in crab fisheries because algal blooms kind of push those crab fisheries to start at a later date. And so what's been happening on the West Coast seafront is trying to create these dynamic responses to marine heat waves and to algal blooms so that fisheries and whales can coexist and be present in the same spaces at different times, and planning ahead and not saying like, okay, each year, this is when the season is going to be, but instead using forecasting. The same thing is being proposed, and hopefully, I'm not sure if it's being used yet, in places where there are increasing droughts. So including in some of the places where I work in Kenya, there's a lot more drought that's been happening because of climate change, and using drought forecasting to plan for when those droughts are going to be and be able to create policies around preventing crop raiding by elephants, that kind of thing, preventing preparing people for, you know, in our case in the Bay Area, in the dry season, we saw that coyotes are more likely to come into your yard and start biting up your irrigation systems and so on and get into conflict in that way. And so how can we better prepare people to secure their yards and so on during dry seasons and then also during increasing drought? So I think that there are ways that we can use these dynamic climate changes year to year to create dynamic policies. And that's something that Brianna and her team talk about a lot in their paper.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have Peter back on the phone. Peter, thank you for your patience. We got you back on.
That's okay. Thank you. You know what you took me back to? Because in 1977, my family took a great vacation to Lake Tahoe. And what I remembered was we went to Mariposa Grove, right, had a cabin there, and we looked out and we're like, shh, look at that, a deer, be quiet. The deer walked up to us, you know, and we had a box of Cheerios. I'm eating Cheerios right now. And the deer, we were feeding the deer Cheerios out of our hands. We were amazed. I mean, this is like something out of Disney World. No. In other words, that's what I was wondering. You're talking about the bear, the interface with wild animals. But here I'm thinking, my experience on Lake Tahoe was these animals were so, you know, inured. Or what's the word?
They were accustomed.
Yeah, there's a word. There's a word for
habituated.
That. Neoteny, right? Or kind of abuse. They were not afraid of people. It was kind of creepy. It was like they would hang out on golf courses. Probably got hit by golf balls. It was just, it was, you know, idyllic. It looked like paradise, but apparently it could be dangerous for the animals in the next generation.
Yeah, and that really brings up something we hear about again and again. And thank you for that, Peter. And that is, You know, we can feel very special and singled out if we can get a raccoon to come to our deck every night and chow down on some leftover cat food. And it's like, oh, you know, this raccoon likes me. And of course, what you're doing is you're acclimating the raccoon to a food source that isn't natural or native to it. Is there an upside to these exceptional human animal interactions? Are they inherently bad?
Ooh, that's a spicy question. And the answer is complicated, right? So in short, like, no, you should never hand feed wildlife. And I think a lot of us have had an experience of doing that. I think bird feeders are a different story and they're more complicated, which we could talk about at a different time or reach out to me. But a lot of us have had experience doing that before knowing that it can cause these issues down the road. And it comes from a really good place, right? Like it comes from our need, our desire, our joy in connecting with nature and connecting with another being that is unlike ourselves, in finding that connection. And it can come from a beautiful place, and you see it all over the internet playing out in terrible ways where like people are going to these places where they abuse big cats and taking these pictures for their Instagram with the baby tiger and so on. And then that tiger ends up getting killed when it gets big enough. People just don't realize, right? Because that drive for connection is so strong. And that's something that I think is really difficult in urban areas or in places where people are coming from a lot of different viewpoints and experiences with wildlife. Something that I'm looking into called these landscapes of, fear and opportunity, where you have a lot of people maybe in a certain area might know that you shouldn't hand feed wildlife. They might know that you should secure attractants and so on and so forth. But then the visitors to that area might not know that, and they want to get those connections. And so to what extent does having those connections versus having these mitigation measures and the non-lethal hazing affect an animal's behavior? How do we deal with the fact that people are coming from such different perspectives in the same small space and influencing animals in these different ways? Like, where's the threshold that makes sure that animals maintain their wariness of us instead of habituating to us? We still don't have that answer for most, if not all, conflict-prone species. Mm-hmm. We don't have the answer of how to prevent that in a space where people are coming from such different perspectives. And, there might be a woman hand feeding coyotes for a while wandering around San Francisco over the past few years. That's probably influencing their behavior single-handedly without other people doing the same. And so I think that the best bet for everyone is to just not hand feed these animals. You may feel like you're connecting with them and in the moment, but what could happen down the road is that the animal could get killed. I want to share a cautionary tale of, you mentioned the name Carl earlier in a sort of a joke, but there was a coyote named Carl in San Francisco, which many of the listeners might have heard of. And he was in 2021 started trying to attack toddlers by the throat in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And he got so close so many times. Fortunately, no one was hurt, but it was very, very rightfully so frightening for parents. And it was persistent and it was in the daytime. And eventually they had to remove him. They had to lethally remove him because it was such a hazard for people. But if you look back into Carl's history, he used to live in a neighboring park in San Francisco. And for many years, he was hand-fed by a woman suffering from homelessness. Who was clearly just trying to connect, right? And didn't have the services and the support that people need. People need housing. People need mental health care. People need connection. And that's something that our country in many places does not provide for a lot of people. And then they're in these parks interacting with animals. And in this case, it was a coyote. And so when she passed away, he moved on and started he had been habituated getting these rewards from people, and it translated into this predatory behavior toward young people. So that's just a cautionary tale, which gets at a lot of the things we've talked about today around equity, right? And around inclusion and justice, and how that filters into how conflicts play out across the landscape. But it also gets at an understanding of why we shouldn't hand feed these animals, even if they're super friendly already, even if maybe you might not be making a drop in the bucket anymore. Just avoid it. Be an example for other people.
What a great story to end on. I thank you so much for that.
Yeah, no worries.
That's Dr. Christine Wilkinson, carnivore ecologist and conservation scientist based at UC Berkeley and the California Academy of Sciences. As well as appreciating her joining us, also thanks to our earlier guest, Ann Bryant, executive director of Bear League. And you can find that group's website at savebears.org. Thank you for tuning into Your Call today. It's good to have you on board. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. If you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. You can call us 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. Jalen Herdman produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angie Carter, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.